Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Capital Party restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Hey there, Marky.
Hey, Francis. How are you this morning?
I'm grand, thank you. Just ducky.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Ducky?
Ducky.
When you say ducky, do you mean that you're going to bring your pet duck into the restaurant because you're emotionally attached to it?
That really wasn't what I meant. No.
Did you see the article in the Times?
Yeah, I thought we weren't going to talk about this.
Yeah, we're going to, though.
Okay, go ahead. That's what I need, more people protesting outside the restaurant. It's great.
There appears to be a new trend in New York City, and we haven't experienced this too much in New Jersey, though we have experienced it, on bringing your pet to a restaurant or to any place on an airplane, wherever. Bring your pet everywhere with you.
And there is a real legal issue that's going to have to be worked out.
Mm-hmm.
Because while... You know, I knew someone who dated a man who was blind and had a seeing eye dog, and this is in the 70s and early 80s,
mm-hmm.
and he had a seeing eye dog, and they would sometimes get turned away from restaurants.
Right.
Look, seeing
which was against, which
was not against the law at the time.
Okay. Well, it was immoral. It was immoral at any time.
Exactly. And now that's against the law, and that's very important, and that's very, very important, and that's so. If someone needs the assistance of an animal that's trained to help them on a plane, in a restaurant, wherever it is, you have to accommodate them, and I think that's great.
And I think that's how we need to start the conversation. We need to start the conversation by saying, it is really, really animals can have a huge impact on a person with a disability's life.
No, go ahead.
And what we want to see is those people have the opportunity to experience some of the other things in life that those of us without those disabilities can experience. And if a dog or a pet of one sort or another can help you experience those things, then I'm all for it.
But here's the deal. There was a ruling in 2003 by the Department of Transportation that clarified policies regarding disabled passengers on airplanes. And this is for the first time states, I got this from an article in the newspaper, states for the first time that animals used to aid people with emotional ailments like depression or anxiety should be given the same access and privileges as animals helping people with physical disabilities like blindness or deafness. So now people who need animals for emotional support can bring those animals on the plane. This has gone so far as to one airline had a passenger show up with a goat who stood in the aisle for the plane ride. I mean...
You know what the issue is? Maybe there are people out there who need emotional support from their animals. Because
there are.
For sure.
And there are people, there are specially trained animals to help people that are emotionally debilitated, and that's sort of not what we're talking about, and it's usually not a goat.
Well, it's proven, okay? It's proven that an animal can help reduce your blood pressure. An animal can help reduce your heart rate. An animal can help you reduce stress. All those things are true. I believe they're true.
But the animal reduces, my pet will reduce my stress if I can take him on the airplane as well. That's not the same as someone who's emotionally disabled who needs that animal to be able to function.
Right, to be able to walk without bumping into somebody. Or if
someone's schizophrenic, maybe, mm-hmm. and they need to have an animal.
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
And
so what do Francis and I want to address here? Well, what we want to address are not the people who truly need these animals, because I don't think that's the issue. For whatever reason that they need these animals. What Francis and I want to address are the people who are using the law to be able to get what they want as opposed to because it's what they
and
need.
So there are all these people showing up at restaurants.
Like I said, according to this article, it's happening in New York City quite a bit. It's only happened to us on one occasion.
But people are showing up at restaurants and saying, yes,
I got you with that one.
This is, and it's like a little toy poodle. And they're like, oh, mm-hmm. and this is my assistance dog. And you're like, well, I can't by law start asking you, you know, well, what is your disability? And, you know, show me the papers. But a lot of people are talking now about having something more than like a note from a doctor, but having to certify whether animals are a support or not. And there are big issues involved in that. But let's face it. Listen, I want to go out with my German Shepherd, and I want to bring him into a restaurant. Well, it's a fine dining restaurant, and the owners don't want me to bring my German Shepherd in. All I have to do is claim a disability, and I can bring in my dog. And that's really bratty, and I'll tell you something.
It's selfish. It's really selfish.
Because it puts at risk the people who really do have a
problem.
That's
the problem. It's not even the, I'm not even saying it's selfish to the other people in the dining room, though I think that there is a piece of that. The big reason that it's selfish is because it lessens the importance of those animals to the people who really need them.
And it puts society to be more prejudiced against them. And I'll tell you that the people who really do provide dog partners and dog assistants, here's a quote from a woman named Joan Froling. She's the chairwoman of the International Association of Assistant Dog Partners, a nonprofit organization representing people who depend on service dogs. The DOT guidance document was an outrageous decision. Instead of clarifying the difference between emotional support animals who provide comfort by their mere presence and animals trained to perform specific services for the disabled, they decide that the support animals were service animals. And I think her position is, you know, emotional support animals don't have the same. Look, if you can't keep it together to go sit in a restaurant without your dog being in the room, you know, that's not the same as someone's blind and the dog needs to show them how to get to the table,
how to cross the street without being hit by a car.
And it also means that dogs trained to assist blind people are specially selected dogs that are extremely well trained. And, you know, we've had service dogs in the restaurant, and they're great. And I understand there are service monkeys out there that help a lot of people who have various disabilities. These animals.
That's what I like to call you.
Actually, I thought it was the dumb waiter when I go up and down the stairs. But
whenever you bring me a drink, I call you my service monkey.
But, well, that's happened for the last time. I hope that you remember the last one well, sear it in your memory. But it's bratty New York people who want to take their dog into the restaurant. And so they pretend, and to me, that's the same as parking in the handicapped spot when you're not
Exactly. Grabbing that little hang tag and saying, you know, I got my doctor to write this up for me, so I'm a fake handicapped person.
Right, like
I hang the hang tag.
I drive my dad to the doctor. I drive my parents around, and sometimes my car is a little convertible. It's hard for my parents to get in and out of, so I drive them around in their Mercury, Taurus, whatever it is, their senior citizen mobile, and I drive around. It's got handicapped plates because my mom can't walk very far, I don't park, but if I'm driving to the store to get them milk, I don't park it in the handicap space even though I have the tags because I'm not handicapped.
Right.
You know, we make those accommodations for people and should make those accommodations for people. And when people try and glom onto that to get what they want, they do a great disservice to our society.
You know how I get my emotional support from my dog?
How?
I go out to dinner.
Uh-huh.
And then I have a really nice dinner and I feel better.
Uh-huh.
And then I go home. And my dog's really happy to see me when I get there. She jumps up and down. She's going,
burr, burr, burr.
And I pat her on the head.
And you give her a bone.
And I feel emotionally supported.
Yeah, that's great. You know, I don't have a dog, but that's because I'm not responsible enough to keep a cactus alive.
Because you want to be out of your house for 20 hours
at
a time.
But I can bring my emotional support cactus into a restaurant whenever I want to. Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to our Restaurant Guys of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. And our guest today is Chef Jeff Gardner. He's the executive chef and co-owner of Restaurant Celle de la Terre in Boston. And he wrote an article recently for a publication called Star Chefs, which is an online publication that we subscribe to, and you should, too. You can link to it from our website. But he wrote this very interesting article on butchering, and we're here to talk to him about that.
Hey, Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Now, Jeff, you wrote this article on butchering, and I think it's very interesting. I used to work in ShopRite when I was a teenager, and actually so did Mark in a different ShopRite. And I remember when, back in the day, there used to
be
butchers.
It's amazing how parallel our backgrounds
crazy,
are.
Crazy, huh? But back in the day, you'd go to a butcher, and then the supermarkets began to have butcher shops. And the meat cutters union in the butcher shop went on strike back when I was, I guess it's got to be 1983, when I was still working in supermarkets. And I noticed over my time in supermarkets how the role of the butcher in the supermarket changed. And now even if there is a butcher in a supermarket, it's unlikely that there is, the butcher, quote unquote, has a different meaning today than it did back then. Will you talk to us, Jeff, about why you wrote this article and what a real butcher does?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think there was a you know, some time ago where you know, animals, you know, came in their entirety, and the butcher would fabricate the entire animal into all its primal parts, and eventually, you know, fully fabricated into the individual muscles and individual cuts that we're familiar with in our butcher shops, if you will, or grocery stores today. But you know, more and more, that type of work is being done, you know, before it even reaches the supermarket or the butcher shop. And I think it's very unusual now to ever see, you know, an entire animal, you know, in the butcher shop. We've become very accustomed to seeing, you know, rack of lamb or loin of lamb or pork chops or something that's already basically ready to cook, ready to eat, and have become kind of separated from where it came from originally.
Yeah, well, Jeff, I mean, you go to a butcher shop now, you can't even get certain parts of the animal. I go, when I make the gravy at home, the Italian gravy at home, I used to go to the butcher shop before we opened our own Italian restaurant. I'd go to the butcher shop and ask for fat back, and they'd be like, we don't have any fat back.
Right.
Well, you should.
Right. It's right. It was on the animal. I'm sure of it.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I you know, I suppose it's a demand kind of thing, because there's, you know, I suppose there's fewer and fewer people that are making their own, you know, sausage or pates or things like that that would require fat back. And I guess if there's not the demand, they stop carrying it.
Well, also, it's a heck of a lot more efficient. I mean, it's a real skill to be an actual butcher and be able to fabricate from animal to cuts of meat that the home cook can use. And also, I think as people cook less at home, they have less patience for the cuts of meat that take longer and require more expertise to make great, which is a shame. But, I mean, what happens is you go from being a butcher shop, and it's still called a butcher shop, but it's actually a meat store. Because
right.
You get in what we call box beef, which may need to be cut down from, you know, subprimal cuts into, which are, you know, basically halfway there to being cut up.
It's frankly more than halfway there from what I see from the butchers in my neighborhood. They're the best you can hope for is that they have a bandsaw and they're cutting steaks to different sizes.
So you wrote this article. Do you think that what's being lost by not having, you know, the people who service or sell us our meat be the actual butchers of the meat?
Well, I think that it's, you know, I think that we forget where our food comes from sometimes, and I think that we risk losing the talent and the art of knowing and being creative and figuring out what to do in order to utilize the entire animal. And, you know, I guess I understand how and why it's become that way, and it's a lot easier for restaurants, and you know, they want to put something on the menu that says rack of lamb, and people want to be able to go to that restaurant and get essentially the exact same looking rack of lamb, you know,
every
single day, every single week, every time they come in, exactly, And it streamlines things, and it makes it a lot easier from a logistical standpoint for restaurants to function that way.
But
I think what's at risk is losing the knowledge, the art of how to utilize everything. You know, what to do with all the other parts and all the wonderful things that can be created with the other cuts of meat and the other parts of the animal.
You know, I think though that it's also it's a respect thing, and when you don't take the whole animal down, you forget what it was. You forget what it came from. And I see a lot of culinarians, a lot of culinary, and I'm not just talking about the home cook now, but Culinary Institute graduates coming out and not really understanding what that came from, and what that was an animal that that gave its life so that we could utilize it and not caring so much in what you were saying about utilization of the whole animal.
I also want to talk about, when we come back, because we have to take a short break, but I want to talk more with Chef Jeff Gardner and his article, this great article he wrote about butchering whole animals and utilizing whole animals, about if you have a restaurant out there and you have talent in your kitchen, how you can use these other cuts of meat that are often less expensive to make dishes that are better and more interesting. Back in just a moment, you're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest is Chef Jeff Gardner. He's the executive chef and co-owner of Restaurant Celle de la Terre in Boston. We're going to link you to how to find him on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. And we're talking with him about butchering whole animals, which is sort of a dying and lost art. Now, do you butcher whole animals as a matter of course in your business, Jeff?
We do. It's not exclusively that way, and you know, we will get some products in from the butcher that are already fabricated or partially fabricated, but we also get entire animals in from small farmers, usually in Vermont, New Hampshire,
Maine. Do you find that you're able to do more interesting things because you have the availability of these, what we call secondary or tertiary cuts, which are maybe take a little more talent to bring out the flavor of, but do you find that you are able to come out with more interesting dishes as a result of it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that you hit on two points there. One is that, yeah, absolutely, you can do more interesting, more creative things. It's a great challenge, and requires a lot more skill, and professional cooks in my kitchen always enjoy learning and working with the entire animal and learning what they can do with all the various parts, because in most cases they've never seen it before. Even if, you know, perhaps if they went to culinary school, they may have seen it once in a class, but even then, a lot of people have never seen the whole animal, so they're intrigued by it and they're curious to learn what to do with it. The quality is usually much greater than, especially because we're usually buying whole animals from small farmers that are raising them in a much more natural way than some of the larger producers.
Yeah, and we've experienced a similar kind of thing because we had a contemporary American restaurant for many years, and now we have an Italian American restaurant as well, which allows us to use on a lot of those dishes, those secondary and tertiary cuts. And we find, and because there are a lot of restaurateurs who listen to the show, we find that as long as you have the talent in the kitchen to know how to utilize the whole animal, that it does a good thing for our food costs. It brings down the cost of meat overall to be able to use these very flavorful cuts. We have to take a quick break from the news, but when we come back, we're going to be talking more with Jeff Gardner about whole animal, using the whole hog, as it were, butchering, and how you in the restaurant business can do better by exploring this option, and how you out there as consumers and diners can do well to find a good butcher and to trust a local restaurant that does butcher a whole animal. You'll find some more interesting stuff. Back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left, Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Our guest today is Jeff Gardner. He's the executive chef and co-owner of restaurant Celle de la Terre in Boston, and we're talking with him about butchering. Great article he wrote in a publication that we really like called, it's an online publication called Star Chefs. You can find out about both Star Chefs and Jeff and Celle de Terre at our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Now, Jeff, you said that it is very unusual, and it is very unusual, and it's because it's something we've only recently gotten into on a regular basis because we two restaurants share one animal. In butchering the whole animal, you come out with these unusual cuts of meat that you wouldn't normally come out with. What kind of things do you do with them that you can present to your customers, and how do your customers react?
Oh, I think that there are some customers that aren't interested, and there's others that jump all over it. They're fascinated, and they can't believe that we're offering Vermont spring lamb, or that we're doing lamb liver or veal kidneys, mm-hmm. or they can't believe the sausages or the pâtés or things like that we're making from some of the animals
And I'll tell you, that's an area that you really see the difference when you're butchering your own meats and making your own sausages and pâtés and things like that. You really see the difference in quality when you're buying whole animal.
Well, yeah, and you know, it's funny. I'm one of those guys who's like, I want to eat everything. And I went in recently and I had dinner with some other culinary friends at Waldy Maloof's place, Beacon, in Manhattan. And he said, "You want me to just cook for you guys?" And we said, "Yes." And then the entree came out, and there was a split head of lamb, and it had a little bit of the brains, a little bit of the tongue was still in there, like split, put back where it was. And, I'm adventurous and I like stuff like that. But, these kind of meats can be used to make things like pâtés and sausages that actually blow people's doors off. So it doesn't have to be something unfamiliar to a guest that you present it
but
to.
But it's not just that. I mean, my grandparents, and it's not to my taste, but my grandparents ate capuzelle. They ate the lamb's head. That was one of the dishes that they adored. And happily, I don't have to eat that anymore. But they loved it.
So are you finding when you put dishes on there that are like the kidney or the liver of the lamb or pork belly we put on our menu that, I think this is self-selecting because a lot of your clientele just won't order that. But mm-hmm. the ones that do are really well rewarded. How are your customers reacting to this kind of stuff?
I think it's a mix, just like you're saying, and I think that sometimes it's a cultural thing. I mean, you talk about your family heritage, and I can certainly think about my grandfather, who again, it's a couple generations removed, but he took great pleasure in exposing me to unusual foods, not that unusual probably by your standards, but to most kids my age, like beef tongue or calf's liver or things like that, most kids these days wouldn't think of eating and would even be difficult to find in butcher shops or grocery stores these days. So I think that there's a, it's a cultural thing. And I think even now when I travel to other countries, I see products prominently displayed in butcher shops or, open markets that are parts of animals that you just don't see in this country. We eat, chicken breast and, maybe mm-hmm. chicken drumsticks here, but, there are other cuts that are extremely popular in other countries and, that we just never even see here because there's no market for it.
Although, Jeff, I have to tell you, one of the cruel injustices of my life was my mother used to make us eat liver at least once a month because it was good for us.
Uh-huh.
And then we found out it wasn't good for us. And I was really, really mad.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you're still okay now, right?
I'm fine.
You live.
I think it's interesting that you point to a cultural difference because, let's take it at the very basic. When you go and look in a butcher shop window in other countries and there's a real butcher, you do see different cuts of meat. And you know what is studiously avoided in our culture? Cuts of meat that look like a piece of the animal they came from. Mm-hmm. They're almost, those are verboten, you know what I mean? People don't want to see that it comes from an animal. And look, we're all for humane methods of animal husbandry. I believe animals can be raised for food. I believe it's moral to raise animals for food. But I think that the animal rights people have a very good argument when they say, listen, if you really knew where your food came from, you would be able to make a better choice. And they think that more people wouldn't eat animals. But I think that, you know, there are a lot of people that have never – can't – don't associate a chicken breast with the breast of a chicken, the animal that they see. And I think that's wrong. I think that people should really see more. When I walked for the first time, I was in Spain – and I walked into their version of a sort of a fast food restaurant, the Museo de Jamón, the Museum of Ham, right?
We should have a museum.
And you walk into the Museo de Jamón, and the whole roof, the whole ceiling, has legs of ham. These are pig's legs with the hoof on them hanging down. And when the bartender wants another one, he reaches up to the wall, the ceiling of death, and pulls down a ham and starts cutting it for you. But, you know, there's something very real about that. I mean, there's something I think, and you're reading your article in Star Chefs, I think that you really wanted people to understand that the food that they're eating comes from an animal and decide whether you're okay with it or not.
Right.
Do you think
I completely agree, and I'm for, you know, humane treatment of animals as well, but I also believe that, you know, it's fine to raise animals for food. I think it's a very natural thing and I don't have a problem with that at all. But I also think it's very humane to if we're going to raise animals for food and consume them for food, that we should use all of the animal for food and not, you know, discard, you know, half the parts and, you know, like you say, only eat the chicken breast. I mean, you know, funny thing, you know, several years ago, I remember it's a little embarrassing, but I actually watched a few episodes of one of the early Survivor shows on television. And I remember they had a chef as one of the people on the show. And here are these people on a, you know, on an island or whatever with nothing to eat. And they actually caught a few fish. And I was flabbergasted that he filleted the fish and cooked the fillets and discarded everything else. I'm thinking to myself, what about the heads, you know? What about the frame? Why didn't he simmer that in water? Why didn't he eat the
bones,
cheek meat? Why didn't he make a soup out of the bones? And it just discarded everything else, which is very common, I think, in today's society.
I think he touched on this. You know, this guy is a chef who's supposed to be, you know, respecting this. He's supposed to be full utilization. He's supposed to, you know, frankly, one of the ways, by using the fish heads and the fish bones and all those other parts of the fish, that you... what you can do is then not charge your patron so much for the fish because you get full utilization out of the fish, as well as not sacrificing as many fish. But you know what? That Survivor guy, there was probably a pot roast about 50 yards away from him. So it probably wasn't that big a deal.
Emaciated despite the premise of the show. But I agree completely. And it's an economic thing. I mean, running a restaurant is a business. And so, you know, you want to, you pay for 100% of the fish or the meat that's coming in the door. And so you want to try to utilize everything because it's a business and we're trying to generate revenue, off of that. But it's also a deeper sort of love of food and appreciation of food. And it pains me to see any food go to waste. It pains me to see, you know, even a morsel of food that is wasted or not used or that goes bad.
Well, let me make a point here, because I think that very often Mark and I often say that, you know, great ecology and great economy are one and the same. You know, if I sent two people out and I said, okay, you go find the most sustainably raised, you know, humanely raised animals that are all organic, and you go out and find the best tasting meat from an animal, they're going to wind up in the same place. And we're not saying, oh, eat some food that's not very good or that's kind of disgusting so we don't waste the animals. We're saying have some talent, have some patience, and we have thousands of years of tradition as to how to cook these animals to make things great. And the liver and the kidneys and the trotters can either of themselves be good or be tremendous ingredients in making food taste better.
Absolutely.
So, you know, it's sort of... we're not asking you to sacrifice to eat the whole animal. We're saying eat the whole animal. It's good. You know, take the time to learn, if you're a food professional, how to use the whole animal. And when you, as a customer, go someplace where they do use the whole animal, you know, reward them with your business. Hey, we'll be back in just a moment. We're talking with Jeff Gardner, executive chef and owner of Sel de Terre. We're talking about eating whole animals, not all at once, but eating whole animals. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant
Maybe
Guys.
A quail.
Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants, and also of The Restaurant Guys radio show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, stage left and Captain Lombardi. Our guest today is Jeff Gardner. He's the executive chef and co-owner of restaurant Celle de la Terre in Boston, and he wrote a great article that really caught our eye for Star Chefs. You can visit them at starchefs.com. It's a great culinary resource. And his article was on butchering animals, and Jeff took, unlike most restaurants you may or may not be aware, Jeff takes whole animals and actually fabricates, which is what we say in the business for, cuts the animal into the parts that we would actually cook. And what I think is very interesting was there's a picture here of a lamb, and you go very much into detail about how to butcher lamb. I don't know who they hired as an artist, but the sad thing is it's someone who's very artistic, and this lamb could be in a children's book, sadly. Because
he's a very cute little lamb.
He's cute, but he's got arrows pointing all over, like shoulder, flank, loin, forehead, you know. And that's really unfortunate. But
I like to do that with my cat at home. It drives my wife crazy. But
yeah, I can see that, as a matter of fact. I can understand that. But I think it's very interesting. And one of the things we talk about is, you know, people say rack, and they don't know where it comes from. And even cooks who've gone to culinary school come into our kitchen sometimes, and we'll do a whole hog, you know, because we can utilize the whole thing, and that's why our food is better. But you have culinary students come in and they're amazed, you know. It's like an anatomy lesson to relate it back to the animal. I mean, do you find that cooks are unprepared for this?
Unprepared and yet fascinated by it, though. When they have the opportunity, they're really excited to see and learn something that that may very well have been skipped over in culinary school. And you know, I'm not criticizing culinary schools. I think that, you know, they're trying to teach students what they need to know when they get out in the business. And most places in the business, they're not going to be faced with butchering a whole animal. So it's probably not something that got touched on in school, but that students are really curious to learn about and have the opportunity to try.
And in reality, in a restaurant, if we're serving porterhouse steaks, where most restaurants, we're not buying a whole cow. It's too big an animal, and there are too many different parts for us to have, you know, 6 porterhouse steaks and 10 filet mignons.
But Mark and I do buy from a union butcher shop in New York for things like that, mm-hmm. for those big pieces, because, you know, we don't have a bandsaw.
Right.
I just want to read this from your step-by-step guide to fabrication. You might want to, I don't know if you're listening
if
out there.
If you're squeamish, this is not for you.
One, get the details before you start. Know when and how the lamb was slaughtered, so you know that whether you want to age it or not. Two, take out the offal. That's not the AWFUL, the OFFAL. Reserve the kidneys, liver, and heart for cooking. Saw off the head. That's always that's interesting. Then step four is saw off the neck. Step five is take off the forelegs. And you go into great detail with each of these things. I think that a lot of people stop reading at saw off the head.
You know? It's kind of like Jeffrey Dahmer's biography or something.
Do you find that people are squeamish when you're teaching them how to do this stuff?
Not professional cooks, no. No, and you know, before doing this this piece for Star Chefs and the actual demonstration that I did at the very large group of people that I did this cooking demonstration in front of, I asked them about that because, you know, a lot of times if I'm doing a cooking class or a cooking demonstration, I want to do something that's interesting, something that's different, something that's informative and maybe that people haven't seen before. And yet at the same time, I don't want to scare people you know, like you said, like you warned people before reading that if you're squeamish, you know, you might want to turn down the volume for a second. But they assured me that this was the audience was professionals, was fellow chefs, culinary students, people like that, and this was the kind of thing that they'd be really interested in. And in fact, they were. I watched as I was doing it, and there was nobody that covered their eyes or ran away or anything like that. People were really interested.
And also, to be fair, Star Chefs is pretty much an industry publication.
Exactly. Exactly.
You have a lot of useful, and I'm going to link to this article as long as it stays up on Star Chefs. You can go to restaurantguysradio.com and read the article. It has a lot of, even as a consumer, it really will give you a lot of insight into your food. And I think it was really great that you took a lot of time to give the definitions of what things are. Like people, to know what a chine bone is important, or to talk about...
Or the bottom round versus the top round.
Or to have things Frenched, and what offal is and what primal cuts are. I think these are words you hear bandied about on the Food Network, but you may not be familiar with exactly what they are, and here they are all defined for you with a little arrows pointing to some cute little lamb. So you really have a very clear idea of what these things are when you're done.
Yeah, you know what they are, and you know perhaps some suggestions of what to do with them, and like you said, from an anatomical standpoint, where they come from. And mm-hmm. I think, like you say, we buy a chicken breast, we don't really think about where, you know, it's so far removed, we don't think about where it came from or anything like that, but now you know hopefully people can have a little bit better sense of the origin of their food. And I think that's important. I think that's a good thing.
I do too. And I think it leads to, see, for me, it doesn't lead me to say, oh, I don't want to eat meat anymore. It gives me, when I first started learning about this, when I started in the business, more respect for these animals and more respect for what an animal does and what a farmer does and what our role is. Listen, we'll be back in just a moment. We're going to be talking more with Jeff Gardner about fabricating meat in general. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1155. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Jeff Gardner. He's the executive chef and co-owner of restaurant Celle de la Terre in Boston. And we're talking about butchering whole animals and how that's really a lost art that hopefully is coming back in the best restaurants and a few places. You make a distinction because you were talking mostly in this article about lamb. And there is, in New York City, there's Keene's Chop House, which is famous for its mutton chop. That's not really a mutton chop. But can you talk to us about the difference between lamb and mutton and young meat as opposed to meat from an older animal?
Sure. I mean, spring lamb would be sort of the youngest, and then you know, regular quote unquote lamb that we're accustomed to, and then mutton would simply be an older animal. And you know, the difference is as the animal gets a little bit older, the flavor intensifies, becomes stronger, and it can be a little bit tougher as the muscles develop more. So I think lamb is the most common. It's sort of in the middle. It's very flavorful and also very tender. And mutton is it's also a wonderful meat. I'm not suggesting that one's better than the other, but it's a stronger, gamier flavor.
Mutton can get much gamier than lamb.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if you want to try sort of a pseudo mutton, it's not really old enough to be considered mutton, I don't think, but it's an older lamb chop that you can go to Keene's Chop House in New York. We have a link to them on our website.
Love it.
Super
and their mint jelly off the charts.
Yeah. Hey, Jeff, thanks for coming on the show. You've been great.
Thanks so much, Jeff.
My pleasure being with you.
That's Jeff Gardner, executive chef and co-owner of a restaurant, Celle de la Terre in Boston, where Mark and I are going to have to go. We'll link it to him on our website, restaurantguysradio.com.
I just have one quick little tidbit for everybody, and talking about buying whole
Which
animals.
Part of the animal does the tidbit come from? Sorry. go ahead.
One quick little tidbit, and that's even when you're shopping in the supermarket, you're better off buying whole chickens than you are buying chicken parts. If there's a problem with a chicken and it's got a damaged wing or something wrong, a diseased leg or something like that. That chicken, the rest of that chicken, they may get rid of
goes
the one
into
leg
the parts.
Goes into the chicken parts. The whole chickens, obviously, are chickens that didn't have any problems.
Or at least healthy enough to remain whole until the end of their lives. Hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.